You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 26th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up in the programme.
You know, it's a temporary solution.
Until when?
Obviously, well, till we get our hands around the problem. We have a real problem. We have people coming into the country, getting into aeroplanes and flying them into the World Trade Center.
And the citizens of those countries are still welcome to the United States, even after President Donald Trump gets his travel ban for some mostly Muslim nations, mostly upheld. Also ahead.
As a matter of fact, California is 40% more energy efficient than the rest of the United States. And if the U.S. simply adopts our policies, we could exceed our U.S. emission target by more than 50%.
Sticking with the theme of people who got elected due to a widespread confusion of celebrity with competence, we'll assess former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's credentials as an environmental campaigner. We'll also look at why Mongolia has joined the global craze for startling election results, and we'll find out what was learned about the present and future of advertising at this year's Cannes Lions. All that and more coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Iraqi forces claim to have repelled a counterattack by Islamic State as they fight to recapture the last remaining blocks of the old city of Mosul. Iraqi television said that the Iraqi flag was now flying over the northwestern district of Farouk near the ruins of the Al-Nuri Mosque destroyed by Islamic State last week. Islamic State now hold barely a square mile of Mosul but may be holding tens of thousands of civilians therein. Albania's general election appears to have been won by the governing Socialist Party of Prime Minister Edi Rama, with early counting suggesting a near majority for the incumbent government, although turnout was down on the previous election to just 47%. Rama has said that he hopes to begin official EU accession talks for Albania before the end of the year. Sweden's government has confirmed that one of the country's citizens has been freed after 6 years as a hostage in Mali. Johan Gustafsson was captured by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in 2011. They abducted him and two other men from a restaurant in Timbuktu. One of the other hostages, Sagariki of the Netherlands, was freed in a raid by French special forces in April 2015. The other, South African Stephen McGowan, remains captive. The details of the negotiations that led to Mr. Gustafsson's release remain unclear. And here in the UK, the minority Conservative government of Theresa May has agreed a deal with the ultra-conservative Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland, which should furnish her with a working majority in the House of Commons. The DUP have been persuaded by an extra £1 billion on spending on Northern Ireland over the next 2 years. While this necessitates heroic cognitive dissonance for Conservatives who criticised opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn for his cosiness with cranky extremists from Ulster, it's also pretty confusing for Labour supporters in favour of austerity-busting infrastructure spending. So either everybody's happy or nobody is, or possibly both. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Now, it was one of the signature promises of his campaign and one of the signature dog's breakfasts of his presidency. Donald Trump's promise of a temporary travel ban on the citizens of a whimsically selected cohort of mostly Muslim nations and a suspension of all refugee admissions. His executive order to this effect was struck down by federal judges in Hawaii and Maryland and criticized in other jurisdictions, but has now been partially restored by the Supreme Court. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's Washington correspondent Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, what part particularly of Trump's ban has the Supreme Court upheld?
Yeah, and we should say this is all sort of temporary, right? I mean, what they did today, the first thing they did was they said that they want to hear this entire case argued on the merits this fall in October on the first day that they come in. What remains, and basically is giving the administration permission to keep part of this in place until then. And they've drawn a distinction between people who have what they call a bona fide connection to the United States, which is to say some sort of legal status here or a connection to an American institution who are being basically recognized as having a constitutional claim here, and those who don't. And so fundamentally, it means that people from those six countries who do not have a business interest in the United States, do not have any sort of paperwork, you know, green card, visa, something like that, basically have been told that they're where Trump wanted them to be in January. The administration can build a framework that subjects them to, you know, what the White House has called extreme vetting. Other people do have a stronger claim to challenge the constitutionality of this, and that's what will be the decision that the court makes in its next term.
You correctly point out that they will be considering this in full in October. Why not just wait until then? Why the necessity for this interim measure?
Well, you know, it's about showing deference to the executive. This, you know, everybody kind of across the sort of political spectrum and of different legal backgrounds recognizes that the President of the United States under the Constitution has exceptional leeway to dictate the terms of who enters the country in much the same way that the President has a tremendous latitude on decisions about national security and how to administer a war. What comes into conflict there is basically the President can do anything controlling who comes in and out of the country as long as it doesn't conflict with another constitutional right. And the place where there would be an issue there is that there's this history of Trump and people around him saying that the reason that they picked these countries and enforced it the way that they did was specifically because of a religious test, which would be impermissible. And so what they're saying is we will hear lawyers from both sides make the case as to whether this has been done with a religious standard and whether then, if done with a religious standard, that sort of supersedes the president's ability to control who comes in and out of the country. But until then, we're going to show basically some deference to what we see as the underlying power of the president to make determinations about who comes and goes from the United States.
Donald Trump will doubtless portray this as the greatest triumph in American history since Yorktown, but how big a win is it for him really?
I mean, it is a significant one in that, first of all, it does show some tipping of the hand on the part of justices. So, you know, Trump, of course, has even in victory misrepresented the scale of it. This is sort of already turning into like the popular vote electoral college of Supreme Court decisions. In his statement put out by the White House this morning, he described it as unanimous. It was not unanimous. It was unsigned. We don't know how the judges broke down other than three of them. Conservative judges basically said that we would have given Trump everything he wanted now, we believe, is sort of how to read their dissent. Otherwise, we don't know among the nine judges how many of them go each way on this. He got a majority on this, sort of leaving half of the plan in place until October. But there is a decent indication that they will be sympathetic enough to his overall arguments, given what they conceded to him now. I mean, generally, the court, if they think that somebody's arguments are going to be hopeless, very rarely will lift stays and allow them to, you know, 4 months of running room with a policy that they see as flatly unconstitutional. So I think he can be heartened by that, and that he wasn't laughed out of court the way that some of the lower courts treated this. This will be a major moment before the Supreme Court where, you know, it is still possible that they, after reading the briefs that and hearing this argued, could come away, you know, where there are five votes saying that this was informed by a religious motive and that the administration had animus in doing this, and strike down the entirety of this executive order. That would be humiliating. So, you know, to the extent that there's a victory, it's at best temporary, but he'd had a very bad run with courts on this particular issue, and certainly having just five of them show enough deference to him to allow him for a few months to enact a version of this while they contemplate the bigger questions is something of a win.
Is it possible, though, that it might actually be a slightly bigger win than even he realizes, in that the fact that they've made this interim decision, might that confuse the picture sufficiently to diffuse any protests, as it were, to make it sort of more difficult for people to realize what they're demonstrating against?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, part of it is that I think the political moment on this has moved. This was the first major area of conflict. This was the first big thing that Trump did as president, 8-9 days into his presidency. And so it was a focal point of protest very early on. 4 months later, I think on a matter of governance, obviously everything related to Russia, the allegations of corruption, the emolument stuff has sort of gained the imagination of protesters who are legally minded. And, you know, we're up against a big vote on healthcare this week in the Senate. Now that you actually see the bones of Trump's budget, his proposals on healthcare, on taxes, stuff like that, there's a lot more for folks on the left to go after that's kind of, you know, more conventional policy critiques. And so I suspect that, you know, the activist energy on this will have dissipated a little bit because there are other targets. It could certainly come back. And, you know, the other big thing is the Supreme Court has been known to be a motivating factor for voters on both sides. And so if this becomes, you know, part of it will just be taking the target a little bit off of Trump on this and putting it on the Supreme Court and possibly signaling to voters who are going to go to elect a senator next year, recognizing that even if you're not going to have a Democratic president or House in 2019, the question of who controls the Senate is really important just for the matter of who gets named to the court if there's another vacancy before 2021.
Sasha Eisenberg in Washington, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, in retrospect, it was a poor decision by the world to unload all its best material about the susceptibility of American voters to the tawdry dazzle of celebrity back in 2003, when the people of California elected as governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, whose only previously demonstrated talent had been for lifting heavy objects. What with one thing and another, it not only no longer seems strange that this happened, but it also seems more or less unsurprising that Schwarzenegger would successfully reinvent himself as an environmental campaigner, in which role he has this weekend been making his case to new French president Emmanuel Macron. Well, joining me with more on this from the governator's former fiefdom is Dan Illich, executive producer at Fusion. Dan, first of all, to this weekend's meeting of minds, do we know why President Macron is giving Schwarzenegger the time of day?
President Macron has a really strong policy of trying to push new climate laws through France. Like he's got a huge program which basically involves increasing the amount of renewables, renovating French homes to make them more energy efficient, and rapid deployment of zero emission vehicles, and he wants to do it all ASAP. So he is in a real hurry to make achievements in the green space as quickly as possible.
So how serious is Schwarzenegger then as an ally in this campaign, by which I guess I'm asking, how serious is Schwarzenegger as an environmental campaigner?
He's deadly serious. Since 2010, he's decided to move away when he moved away from being, of course, the governor of California. He went ahead and founded something called the R20, which is the Regional 20, a body of universities, states, cities, regions that all come together to fight climate change on a regional level. So this is an organization that he's founded, and this organization continues to do good work today. So he is he's deadly serious about it, and this is his main passion right now. So it's kind of we may make fun of him being the governator. We may make fun of him using his profile to ridicule Trump, but what he's doing behind the scenes is some serious work, and he's been doing it for the last 7 years.
Well, he has, of course, used his platform to ridicule Trump, and not unamusingly, it does have to be said. But in retrospect, does Schwarzenegger's run for the California governorship kind of look like a trial run for Trump's run for the US presidency? That they were quite similar enterprises in many ways, sort of a well-known entertainer with no particular political experience takes a shot at high office just because he fancies it and because he thinks people like him.
Perhaps, but also I think that Schwarzenegger is a totally different human being who's worked his way up from nothing. So whereas Donald Trump has been kind of given every break he's ever needed his entire life. So when it comes down to it, I think you're talking about two very different personalities, one of which who is eminently qualified and has really pulled himself up from his bootstraps from very humble beginnings.
What do Californians make of Schwarzenegger's governorship in retrospect? I mean, I grant that everything in American politics is now seen through this absolutely weird prism where, you know, George W. Bush looks like Thomas Jefferson. But is Schwarzenegger basically fondly remembered?
I think enough time has passed that, you know, a lot of Californians tend to forget the history. But when he left office, his approval rating was probably in the 20s. So he wasn't very popular then, but he certainly is popular now because Californians, as many people know, is a very liberal state. And so anybody that's publicly having a go at Donald Trump will be looked upon favorably. California was a tough time with California. He had budget shortfalls. Unemployment was around 13-14%. But there are significant achievements he made in climate policy here.
I mean, as you correctly point out, California is a liberal state, arguably the liberal state. It did nonetheless elect and then re-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger, as a Republican governor. Could Schwarzenegger's appeal go the other way? Could he be the kind of Republican who could sell liberal, in inverted commas, causes like environmentalism to Republicans? He and Macron have been using the slogan, "Make the planet great again."
Yeah, that's right. And I think Arnold Schwarzenegger, this is one of the main drums that Arnold Schwarzenegger has been beating. He really wants to drum into people that we all live on the same planet, we all eat the same food, we all drink the same water, we all breathe the same air, whether you're Republican or Democrat. And so he's really trying to depoliticize the whole idea of climate change and environmental justice. So I don't know whether he can achieve it, despite his massive biceps, but he certainly looks like he is. Now, I have to tell you, I saw him in the street the other day because I live in Venice, and he was riding his bike to the gym, and I thought, that is great. That's fantastic. It's so good to see a true climate campaigner riding his bike around the place. So that was, he's doing his part at least. What are you doing, Andrew?
I haven't been to the gym today or indeed on a bicycle, but that's only because I don't own a bicycle or go to a gym. Returning to Schwarzenegger, though, is he kind of having to do that thing, though, of having to sell this stuff overseas to the cheese-eating Europeans because he knows there's not as much of a market for it back home in the United States?
No, I don't think that's it at all. I think what is happening right now is the Paris Accord was in 2015. And what a whole bunch of countries and pretty much the rest of the world is doing is moving on to finding out how they can achieve those goals set in the Paris Accord. So what is happening right now in France is President Macron, with the help of the Prime Minister, Fabius, is trying to figure out ways to build a mechanism in which countries can proceed with goals at a more stringent pace. weeks. So what is happening right now is a global pact on human rights that is being drafted in France to be presented to the UN. Around environmental justice, basically saying that humans have the human right to a clean environment. So that's the next mechanism that's going to be happening. And also they're trying to create something that's a legally binding polluter pays situation where if you are a polluter and you are a heavily polluter, you will pay for that in a legally binding fashion. So these are really tough things that France is trying to do in terms of global leadership, and it will remain to be seen whether that's achieved. So I think what we need to think about when we talk about climate change is something a lot broader than just what's happening inside the Beltway in DC or inside Trump Tower. This is a global issue, and countries are steaming right ahead to figure out ways to deal with it.
Dan Illich with Fusion in Los Angeles. Thanks, as always, for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, the current global trend for novel, unlikely, unpredicted, or plain inexplicable election outcomes appears to have spread as far as Mongolia, which seems set for an unprecedented second-round runoff in their presidential election. This follows an inconclusive three-way split in the first round. Koltmar Boltalja, a martial arts star turned businessman, appears to have made it through. As we go to air, it is unclear whether he will face Migombo Enkhold of the ruling Mongolian People's Party or former feng shui practitioner Sankhu Ganbatar of the Mongolian People's Revolutionary Party. Splitters. To explain how Mongolia got here, here's Monocle's Kenji Hall from our Tokyo Bureau.
When Mongolians go to the polls to pick a new president, they will do so for only the seventh time since they chose democracy over communism in 1990. For this country of 3 million, it will be another milestone. Another opportunity to rejoice. Democracy is still a relatively new concept for Mongolia, a country that spent 7 decades under the influence of the Soviet Union. Among the electorate, voting still brings a sense of empowerment, of having the means to get rid of officials who don't live up to expectations. In last year's parliamentary election for the 76 seats in the state Great Hurl, that's exactly what happened. Voters handed the Mongolian People's Party, previously in the opposition, a landslide victory. The Mongolian People's Party took 65 seats, while the Democratic Party, previously in power, got just 9. Two other parties picked up 1 seat each. It was a clear message of dissatisfaction over what many people saw as economic and political paralysis. How that will play out in the presidential election remains unclear. At the moment, the contest looks set to be between the two leading political parties. The ruling Mongolian People's Party is fielding Enkhold, the influential parliamentary speaker who previously served as prime minister and mayor of Ulaanbaatar, the capital. The opposition Democratic Party is backing Batulga, a former minister of transportation and agriculture, and a former martial arts world champion. Opinion polls taken by the Sainte Morale Foundation, the country's leading pollster, suggest that the Mongolian People's Party has the edge. But when it comes to candidates, voters have a clear favorite. Enkhbayar, a former president who was jailed in 2012 on corruption charges. He's affiliated with a third party, the Mongolian People's Revolutionary Party. But election commission officials could decide that he's ineligible on a technicality. Whoever wins will be eager to tackle the country's most pressing problems, unemployment, poverty, and an economy that's overly dependent on mining. There are, of course, many other challenges. A widening gap between rich and poor. The 21% of Mongolians who now live below the poverty line. Pollution in Ulaanbaatar, the capital. Corruption among government officials. And the threat of reprisals against the independent news media. Even now, it's hard to put completely to rest concerns that Mongolia might be swayed by its 5 ex-Soviet neighbors in Central Asia. Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, all led by repressive regimes. In the end, who wins Mongolia's presidential election probably won't matter that much. It'll be more important that Mongolia's elections are fair and free.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall in Tokyo. You are listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Time now for one of our regular check-ins with one of our bureau chiefs for a roundup of what is occurring on their beat. Tonight we go to Ed Stocker in New York. Ed, first of all, the ongoing saga of Philando Castile, there will be a settlement with his family. Is that at odds with the verdict reached in the trial of the officer who shot him?
I mean, this is, I guess, part of a story, really, isn't it? The fact that essentially we've seen a pattern, I think, on Monocle 24 and, you know, more widely, the fact that white police officers often get away with shooting black people in the US. Obviously, it's a little bit more complex than that, perhaps, but this seems to be the case that's happening again and again. I mean, we can touch on so many people that it's happened to, you know, the person who shot Eric Garner, Tamir Rice. There's an upcoming of Laquan McDonald in Chicago. We'll have to see what happens there. But this is part of a pattern. And, we're seeing a settlement being reached, $3 million with Minnesota City for that shooting. And it came 10 days after the officer involved in that shooting was acquitted of second-degree manslaughter, the name of that officer, Geronimo Yanez. And just to kind of continue on that theme, it came kind of hot on the heels of an agreement being reached by the family of Michael Brown, who you may remember was killed by police back in 2014. We don't know how much was reached in that instance, but it's been reported it may be worth around $1.5 million. And just last year, Cleveland agreed to some $6 million to the family of Tamir Rice, who was that 12-year-old who was shot in the city of Cleveland while playing with a replica gun. So a pattern, as I said before, of this just being repeated throughout, and this issue of not only gun crime but white officers shooting black Americans resurfacing again in the US.
Okay, well, let's move on to the Supreme Court. We talked about the Supreme Court at the top of the show, obviously, in their kind of temporary upholding of parts of Donald Trump's travel ban. They also have another case before them.
Indeed, the Supreme Court wading into more controversial waters, not only related to Donald Trump. This is a case that's gone on for a while. It's basically surrounding a cake maker, even not a cake mater. I don't know what that would be. In the state of Colorado, who basically said that he didn't want to make a cake for a gay couple on their wedding. This was back in 2012 that he refused to make that cake. This is the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop in a place called Lakewood in Colorado. Now, of course, Colorado and some 20 other states have plenty of civil rights legislation and protection for gay and lesbian couples in terms of their rights and their civil rights, to be more exact. The argument which has gone to the Supreme Court has made the decision on Monday to hear it, is that he's not an ordinary tradesman. That kind of gives him an out clause in a way. He's arguing that he's an artist and that he has a First Amendment freedom to stop him kind of expressing ideas that he isn't happy with or doesn't agree with. He is saying that cake making is a creative, expressive art, and therefore making a cake for a couple that expresses something such as celebrating their wedding would be against his beliefs. So it's kind of a slight twist on this idea, and I guess a way of kind of trying to circumvent any anti-discrimination legislation that may be in place. Interestingly, though, the Supreme Court has refused to hear something similar that happened in New Mexico back in 2014 upholding a discrimination finding under state law against a wedding photographer who refused to shoot a same-sex ceremony. So interesting to see that in this case, the Supreme Court, although obviously we don't know what the outcome is going to be, is at least going to hear this case. And we'll have to wait and see what the developments are on that one.
This is going to be one of those ones where everybody on both sides is incredibly angry, and whatever the result, they loudly insist that it proves whatever they already thought was right all along, isn't it?
Well, you could say that. I mean, obviously, this is one of those issues, and there are plenty of them in the US, and I'm sure not just here, that polarize, and people have strong opinions on both sides.
There was a very similar case to this in Northern Ireland quite recently, actually.
Oh, yes?
Yes. In fact, almost literally the same thing, as I recall. What I don't recall off the top of my head is which way the verdict went down. Finally, we should move along to the case of Martin Shkreli, who was... he acquired a measure of unwanted online fame a while ago by hiking the price of pharmaceuticals that his company made. A certain amount of comeuppance appears in the offing.
I mean, a kind of larger than life, slightly bizarre character. You say he attracted unwanted attention, but this guy, who has been nicknamed Farmer Bro by the US media, by the way, seems to kind of revel in a certain amount of attention. Since his arrest, he was arrested in 2015. He's been under arrest for about a year and a half. He's kind of been flaunting via social media his wealth. He's made a purchase of an album for reportedly a couple of $1 million, a rare music album, and has kind of offered cash rewards for certain things. So he's by no means trying to sort of stay out of the limelight. Yes, what you just said, he attracted a lot of attention back in 2015, where he hiked the price of a drug used by people, AIDS patients, to help them live longer by 5,000%. He was the head of that drug company at the time. But actually, this case is unrelated to that. He's basically accused of siphoning off money while he was head of a biopharmaceutical company called Retrofin in order to pay money he owed investors in hedge funds. And so he's basically accused of security fraud. I think obviously the reason that it's getting so much attention is because of the kind of character he's proved, not only this hike of 5,000%, but also this profile that he's kept since his arrest, the fact that he's refused to sort of stay out of the limelight. And he actually was banned from Twitter in January. So this trial, taking place in Brooklyn, it's expected to last between about 4 and 6 weeks in total.
Ed Stocker, Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Join us as we discover the developers who are rethinking the property world, how you can build stores that work in a click-and-shop world, what the most inspirational entrepreneurs are planning, how you make a hit restaurant or fragrance firm, the media brands to watch, how we can green our cities, the future of transport, and much more besides. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
Your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, today, Israel is, of course, a place where the very old meets the very new. Museums heaving with antiquities and innovative tech startups both have a place here, and so do Tel Aviv beach holidays and ancient pilgrimage routes. But what does this mean for Israel's contemporary designers, artists, and makers of stuff? How do they navigate the country's historical grab bag of influences, ranging from Byzantine to Bauhaus, and try to come up with something identifiable? Israeli. That is the focus of this week's edition of Section D, Monocle's dedicated design show. In this preview, Mary Pelletier reports from Tel Aviv, where the country's founding fashion is undergoing a renaissance.
Before the State of Israel even existed, new Jewish immigrants already had a defining style, and that style was Atta, spelled A-T-A. Atta was Israel's first textile and clothing company, established in 1934. Their no-nonsense trousers and boxy button-down shirts became the pioneering Israeli uniform. In the austerity years of building a new country, everyone wore Atta, even the prime minister. Bankrupted in the 1980s, the only Atta available for the past 30 years had to be hand-me-downs. But today, on one of the busiest corners of Tel Aviv's Rothschild Boulevard, Atta is back in business.
Atta was never about fashion. It was about clothing. Atta was an historical textile factory which was established in the north of Israel for two reasons. One, to supply work for the new Jewish immigrants in Israel, and two, to create clothes for the new Jewish immigrants to Israel.
That's Shahar Sigal, the Israeli businessman behind the rebirth of the Atta clothing line. Dressed in a soft gray Atta tee, topped off with the brand's unbuttoned casual red and white striped shirt, he's at home in his new shop, the second Atta store to open in Tel Aviv in the past year. He's surrounded by casual clothes in bold primary colors. They're trendy in an understated way, billowy shirts with boxy lines, and comfortable trousers in cotton fabrics.
What was right, then wrong, became right again, in the sense of, I think people crave to buy clothes which will last a lifetime, which they can wear forever, which they can give to their kids, which have this very classic, simple design with a very high quality of manufacturing and cloth.
Shahar teamed up with veteran Israeli stylist and designer Yael Schenberger to revive the brand, something that, in the face of a booming fast fashion economy, wouldn't be easy. But Atta has the nostalgia factor. Its blue and white triangle logo is iconic throughout the country. For young Israelis, it reminds them of the clothes their grandparents wore. Yael scoured the country for vintage pieces.
Most of my research was physical research, to look for the clothes and to learn from the clothes. First of all, I spread the rumor that I'm looking for Atta clothing, and it helped a lot. Accidentally, also, I found a shop in Petah Tikva. It was as if you got back on time, exactly like Atta shop used to be. A full shop. I called Shachar. Shachar said, buy it all.
In Israel's early years, the government handed out clothing ration cards to be used in Atta's shops. They produced clothes that could withstand working the land on the country's new kibbutzes, school uniforms for children, and weekend clothes as well. It was a literal one-stop shop for the entire country's wardrobe, even Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion.
First of all, I took the Olim Chadashim package, the blue shirt, the white shirt, the Shabbat shirt, the blue pants, and the kova tembel, and the hat. And I took these pieces and I tried to understand why they look the way they looked. It looked simple at the beginning. All the shapes originally came from uniform, school uniform, army uniform, are comfortable in a very unique way.
So how do you make an anti-fashion icon fashionable again? Yael stuck to the basics. The Shabbat shirt and blue pants are near replicas. But she also began working with new fabrics, adding pockets and adjusting necklines, trying out classic designs in floral or checked prints.
They were growing the cotton, weaving the fabrics, dyeing the fabric. You won't be able to wear it because it's uncomfortable in a way that we are too spoiled to wear it now, you know? This is what we call Ben Gurion shirts. So the fact that I made it from another material, it's updating.
It changes it.
Totally changes. Mm-hmm. Whenever you change the material, the garment look different than it used to.
Each new Atta piece is made in Israel. The company is one of the few textile manufacturers working in the country's increasingly high-tech landscape. Though their small new shop is divided into men's and women's looks, young Tel Avivians mix and match the styles, which are effectively unisex. It's a characteristic pulled from the country's earliest design ethos. Keep it simple.
There is a design, an Israeli look. What is it? Very difficult to define in words. But I think when as an Israeli and then Yael as an Israeli designer, I can identify it. I can look at it and say, yes, I know this is something originated here. It smells, it looks, it feels local.
You can hear more on that and other design stories on Section D tomorrow at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other programs anytime you like after that on our website, monocle.com. You're listening to The Daily. Up next, the Asian newspapers. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatized am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
It is time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again by Agatha Kratz, Associate Policy Fellow for the Asia and China Programme at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Agatha, we start with the Asia Times. Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, is the latest foreign leader to sit the Donald Trump handshake challenge. How is this going to go as a meeting of minds, do we think?
Well, no one really knows because... During the campaign, Trump was actually very nice to India compared to China. It has business interests there, so there might be something going on there. But overall, he had very nice words to India. And then once he was elected, Trump kind of changed his posture on many fronts. The first one being trade, because the US has a big trade deficit with India, so he started to get tough on India and criticizing India for that. But also climate, if you remember when Trump pulled out the US of the Paris Agreement. He was criticizing India a lot for getting billions of dollars out of this deal, and it wasn't fair, etc., etc. So actually, relations have gotten tense, and so no one really knows what to expect.
But if you look at the pattern of other foreign leaders that Trump seems to take to, Modi does tick quite a lot of those boxes. He's a authoritarian would be overselling it, but he's certainly a strong man who sees himself as a very business-oriented, great modernizer. They might get on all right. You could imagine that.
I mean, they have a lot in common. They're one of the things
golf.
Is. Yeah, I don't know if he plays golf, but he certainly tweets, and they've actually tweeted nice stuff to each other already. They said they were friends and they were looking forward to seeing each other. Both of them have more than 30 million followers. They're also, as you said...
He hasn't got more followers than Trump, has he? I can imagine that being difficult.
He probably does. It's India.
Oh, dear. Oh, in that case, this whole thing is doomed. It's going to go nowhere at all. Okay, well, we've sorted that one out. Mark our words. That's where it is all going to go horribly wrong for the US-India relationship. Moving along to the Straits Times. This is ongoing protests in Hong Kong. And this is, I think, last time you were in, you brought in a story about how young folk in Hong Kong see themselves increasingly as Hong Kongers rather than Chinese. And is this more of an expression of that sense of independence that they're getting?
Yeah, I mean, what I was saying last time, and it was it was a striking number, 3.1% of the young Hong Kongers feel Chinese, so that's nothing.
That's astonishing, because I am so old that I can remember being in Hong Kong rather for the handover 20 years ago, and asking Chinese people in Kowloon, you know, whether they were worried about it, and the answer I kept getting from them was, why would we be worried? We are Chinese.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is extraordinary that 20 years later, especially among the younger generation, that's gone.
Yeah, so apparently I was looking at the polls again today, and it culminated around 2008. And since 2008, it's just gone down, this feeling of being Chinese rather than Hong Kongese. But I mean, what the press is describing is small but symbolic protest against Xi Jinping coming for the 1st of July, which is the anniversary of the handover. And you know, those are small protests, but they're important because they're youth-led. Once again, they're led by Joshua Wong, for example, which symbolizes this feeling of Hong Kong-ness and this desire for more democratic processes.
But the veterans of the native Hong Kong political establishment are behind them. I was pleased to see Emily Lau quoted in this story. I met her in 1997, pleased to see she's still going.
Yeah, but they're not alone, and there's a big sense, you know, of course, of not having enough democratic freedom, but certainly of also losing some part of the Hong Kong identity. And I think what we've seen the last few years with the press being muzzled, and with you know, you remember this story about the booksellers being kidnapped into China and forced to confess on TV. I mean, all of this has really put Hong Kongers under pressure, but also made them feel like they were going, or they were under threat to lose their identity.
We want to move on to Channel News Asia. This is a story, well, it's China, I guess, showing a measure of clemency, but I don't really see in the circumstances what option they have. Liu Jibao is extremely ill by the sound of it.
Yeah, exactly. So he's been diagnosed on May 23rd with late-stage liver cancer. So he's been, he's on parole, medical parole, which means that instead of being in prison, he's in hospital, and he has the right to be in hospital. He's not at home, he's not free, but it's a certain, as you say, a certain measure of, just letting him spend the last few days or months that he has left maybe closer to his family.
I mean, they have to, really, don't they? Keeping a terminally ill Nobel Peace Laureate in prison would be a bit much even for the Chinese
Communist
Party.
Yeah, exactly. And people are already criticizing the power for not giving him enough medical follow-up, which might have led to them discovering this so late.
Okay, so, well, finally, we do need to move along to the South China Morning Post and the panda story, because, you know, it's a story about pandas. It's pretty much the same story that there always is about pandas, which is China just sending them somewhere in order to curry diplomatic favor, but it's a story about pandas, so it's
we need
in.
It to.
Yes, who is China sending pandas to and why?
So Germany, and it's been 10 years of negotiation to get those pandas to Germany. It's a 15-year loan, which is what China usually does, but the fun part of the story is that apparently they were treated as celebrities. So they were flying first class, they were given cookies all the way, they were followed everywhere by journalists, and the convoy that got them to the zoo didn't have to stop at any red sign, so it was a big deal. And Xi Jinping and Angela Merkel are going to go visit.
Of course
soon.
They are. I mean, the panda diplomacy thing has been a thing for a long time. Is it as important a weapon in China's soft power arsenal as it used to be, say, 20, 30 years ago, when that was basically the only thing anybody knew about China, was that it was where pandas came from?
I don't think it's a big deal. I mean, I think the people in Berlin going to the zoo are very, very happy to see pandas, because that's, it's usually China is the only place where you can see them. But other than that,
who isn't happy to see pandas?
It's not a big deal. It would be a big deal if they lost them, or if anything happened to them, then there would be a big backlash. But apart from that, no, I don't see a big significance there. It's just a cute story to finish the night.
Agatha Kratz from the ECFR, thank you as ever for joining us. Pictures of the pandas are, of course, available online. You are listening to The Daily. Finally tonight on the Monocle Daily, this weekend just passed has seen the 64th iteration of the Cannes Lions International Festival of Creativity, an annual gathering of the advertising, communications and related industries. And like all such gatherings of all such people in recent times, this year's festival was dominated by discussion of what the future of advertising, communications and related fields might actually look like. Well, I'm joined now by Jason Kurian, Global Finance and Economics Editor at Quartz. Jason, first of all, for the uninitiated, and I am myself among them, give us some sense of the event. What's it like as a thing to go to?
Yes, well, it's quite something. Big, sprawling. It's in the same place where perhaps what more people know about the Cannes Film Festival is held. As I understand it, it's much bigger. Big sprawling event. It's all takes place along the beach on the Riviera. So obviously a beautiful place to be. Marketers, agencies, advertisers, creatives, tech companies, everybody who's anyone really in the media industry broadly is there. So a lot of heavy hitters and a lot of yachts and rosé being drunk.
I think that's most of the time in Cannes, in fairness. But you compare it to the Cannes Film Festival, and obviously at a film festival, the thing that is going to go on is going to be films. At an event like this, what are people going to see and do?
Sure. So the ostensible reason behind it is that it's an awards show. So every evening in various categories, there are awards given out, Grand Prix, gold, silver, bronze to various advertising campaigns for like print, outdoor, radio, online, those kinds of things. So it's built around the awards, but really it's much bigger than that now. And big agencies, big tech companies, rent out parts of the beach or boats or cabanas, and they run their own kind of side programming. So it's there to kind of for the advertising industry to celebrate itself, but really it's become kind of like a Davos for the ad industry now, where everyone comes and meets and does deals and checks in with each other and takes the kind of pulse of what's going on.
Well, on that front, in terms of the pulse of what's going on, was there whether it was imposed or whether it just sort of appeared, was there a particular theme to the discussions at this year's event?
Right. Well, there was probably a few different streams. I mean, the one that has probably been the case for a few years now is that everyone in the ad industry now is, let's say, frenemies, perhaps, with the big platforms, meaning Facebook and Google. Huge swathes of ad spending now take place on Facebook, Google, to a lesser extent, other social media platforms like Twitter, Pinterest, those types of things. So the traditional relationship between agencies and brands is kind of breaking down a bit. Brands can advertise directly onto Google or Facebook. Agencies are running campaigns that don't rely as heavily on things like billboards and television. And so everything there is in flux. And there are these new, very wealthy platforms that are muscling in on the work that, you know, the kind of madmen types that the agencies used to do. That's kind of overlying everything. And then there was also a lot of chat about how AI and machine learning and kind of chat bots and that kind of thing are affecting the ad industry. And yeah, a bunch of other things. But really, a lot of it is very technical. And that's why you see people like Google and Facebook having absolutely enormous presences at Cannes over the past few years.
I mean, the key question there, and I guess it's the only question where all this newfangled sort of advertising is concerned, is has anybody figured out whether any of it actually works in terms of selling the product that's being touted?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, they can know even at a more granular level than they did before. So when you run an ad on Facebook or on Google, for example, in theory, you can track, you know, you can trace the user journey from when they see the ad to when they click through to a page and then give you their email address or buy something, which you wouldn't know if somebody's just driving by a billboard in their car. So in some ways, there's much better metrics, much better measurement with the sort of social media and online advertising, which, you know, makes some agencies nervous and also raises more, I don't know, existential questions about what creativity means and whether this is all just about, you know, the grubby business of selling stuff, which it always has been. But, you know, with that awards sort of stream along it, they also want to celebrate, you know, creativity and inspiration and new thinking, and not just whether or not an ad, you know, delivered a certain amount of clicks or not.
I mean, I'm skeptical myself. I speak as somebody who recently ordered a new TV unit online, well, a few months ago, and the internet seems to think that that was me starting a collection of TV units, because that's all I've had advertised to me ever since, and I've already got one. But that aside, were there any particular recent developments or campaigns that people were actually excited about that they think might work and are the future?
Sure. I mean, a lot of the campaigns that I really noticed that won some of the bigger awards definitely were run on a tighter budget, let's say, but which were much more creative with how they used social media and that sort of thing. And so I'm thinking about, for example, there's a company called Jet.com that ran a campaign around the Super Bowl, where in the U.S. the big American football tournament, where they bought Google keywords for Super and Bowl rather than Super Bowl, and they were advertising basically their dishware. And so when you Googled Super Bowl, their ads came up, and it was very popular, and that sort of thing. And then you had other things. One of the biggest winners was this statue called Fearless Girl, which is of a little girl, which State Street, an asset manager, put outside of the New York Stock Exchange along Wall Street, that was basically staring down the famous bronze bull statue there. And that garnered huge amounts of attention, made a lot of comments about gender diversity, that kind of thing. So in a way, you know, it was just a very tiny kind of bronze statue, but generated huge, you know, social buzz. And that's really the whole point now, because the people are on social media. And so everything that brands do basically need to acknowledge that and generate buzz and get people to share and talk about their campaigns. And that doesn't require a lot of money, but it does require a lot of creativity, let's say.
Jason Carayan from Quartz, thank you very much for joining us. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Ben Ryland. The researchers were Jolene Goffin and Fia Matajazana. Our studio manager was Kiran Banerjee. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now. I'll be back with The Daily at the same time tomorrow. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.